that there. Great. And my name is Jordy Izzard, and I'm so glad to be here today with Graham Leonard, who was at SICE through the class of 1949. And today's date is February 24th, 2011. And thanks so much for being here with us. And I'm just going to ask you a few questions, and we'll go down memory lane. So the first question just is, what originally brought you to SICE?
Well, I'm an East Tennessee hillbilly in Kingsport, Tennessee, was at the University of Tennessee, and the most important person in the world at that time was Gandhi. So I wanted to go and live in one of Gandhi's ashrams. So I wrote and applied in my junior year and got accepted to one of the ashrams. But Gandhi was killed the last of January in my senior year at the University of Tennessee. So I was less interested in going to India then because I couldn't meet Gandhi. And I heard that there was an Aramco scholarship, Arabian American Oil Company scholarship, to the School of Advanced International Studies. Now, an East Tennessee hillbilly who had studied international relations, which is supposedly a political science, but of course, politics is not a science, as I learned. But at any rate, I applied and got it. I came up Easter weekend and interviewed with Colonel Bill Eddy, who was the first minister to Saudi Arabia and was on the board of SAIS. And at that time, SAIS and the Middle East Institute were very closely integrated. We were on Florida Avenue, and around on 16th Street was SAIS. It was the Middle East Institute. And a graduate of the class of 48, Bill Marsh, was executive secretary of the Middle East Institute. And so I was in the Middle East Institute at SAIS and did Arabic and so on. Mm-hmm. And I started the study of Arabic there with George Macnessy. George Macnessy had been a Lebanese kid brought up in Detroit that was, a family sent him back to Lebanon when he was 13 or 14 to be a Jesuit priest. And so he studied all of that and was about 20 when World War II began. And so he went down and signed up at the embassy, and they drafted him. And in its infinite wisdom, the army sent him to the South Pacific, though he knew Arabic and French like a Frenchman or an Arab. He was a brilliant scholar. But he was always so impressed by these young consuls at the embassy that he decided that's what he wanted to do. Well, while he was in the army, he met a girl from, a good Maronite girl from Detroit, and they married. And so started having children. They had, I think, 11 eventually. But anyway, he came to Georgetown to do the Foreign Service course masters and taught at SAIS to help supply his family. Well, George later then went to Princeton, where he had a fight with Hitti. He corrected Hitti in class, and George was right. And so Hitti was hit the scene. By that time, Hitti was a god, not just an icon, he was a god. And so George went to Paris to study with Massignon, and he did a doctorat d'etat. And when I went to Harvard to finish my PhD, I took courses with George Macnessy. And he's the foremost expert on the Abbasids. And one of the things that I'm doing now, I've spent almost 40 years, this is part of one of your other questions later, about 40 years in the Middle East as an educator. Mm-hmm. And now I have a project with the Ministry of Education trying to revive Abbasid discussion-based education in Arabic. Mm-hmm. And most of my ideas came from George's books.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah. All right, now that's the first. Now, second, there were two people from Kingsport, Tennessee, believe it or not, at SAIS in the class of 49. The other was Genevieve Collins, the daughter of I.T. Collins, a local character in Kingsport, a lawyer. And she'd gone to Duke, but she had been so coddled by her father that at SAIS, I had to sit next to her to cut her meat for her at the table. She was absolutely, and she, one of our professors, Dr. Paul M.A. Leinbarger, who was raised in China because his father was extraterritorial judge in China, and Paul M.A. Leinbarger fell in love with Genevieve and they got married. And about a year or so later, Genevieve stopped to visit us in Beirut on our way to meet Paul in Nepal on our own. That marriage absolutely transformed Genevieve. Anyway, we remained very close friends throughout life because I saw her every Christmas and Easter when I was home in Tennessee, and Paul too. And Paul from being a kind of a stuffy professor who incidentally also wrote lurid, sexy novels on the side under a pseudonym, which Genevieve continued after his death. They made quite a bit of money on it. And Paul was a great scholar, and he would dictate to one secretary on scholarly work and another on these sex novels he wrote. He was a real character. And he really started looking 20 years younger after he married Genevieve. And it was a really almost unbelievable love story. And that's one of the stories of Saïs. Mm-hmm. And now while we're talking about the dining room, we had a marvelous German chef at Saïs. We had wonderful meals. And what brought us all together is we were living in that awful old building. It used to be Holton Arms, right across from where Reagan was nearly assassinated. Building doesn't exist anymore, but it was there, right, 1906 Florida Avenue. And this dining room, we kept us together. We had the dining room and the library, which we were all in all the time. And my roommate was Manfred Halperin, later PhD from Saïs, one of the early PhDs from Saïs, who was the Middle East sociologist at Princeton all his life. And I was in their wedding. He got married to Betsy that Thanksgiving, so I was the best man in their wedding. And he was married in the home of Supreme Court Justice Rutledge. And Rutledge's daughter was maid of honor, and I was best man. Mm-hmm. So, and the Rutledges invited me to the inauguration with Truman when the Point Four was announced in January 1949. So another mm-hmm. connection with Saïs. And one of my good friends was the CIA began that year. So almost everyone at Saïs was interviewed for CIA. I was not. I don't know why. I suppose I talk so much that they decided I wasn't a good candidate. But at any rate, several friends of mine did work for CIA. One of them was Joe Culbertson. Joe Culbertson's father was the man who got Harry Truman into politics in Missouri. A farmer was involved in politics. And Joe was a very interesting character who spent most of his career training secret intelligence people all around the world for CIA. Married a lovely girl, Mary, I've forgotten her maiden name, Wells, a Vassar graduate, and they had three children, two boys and a girl. And we lived in Beirut at the time, in the Middle East at the time, when all airplanes had to stop because of gas in Beirut and so forth going. So I saw the Culbertsons quite often as they were going back and forth. And the Culbertsons worked with a family from my home part of East Tennessee, a Swiss-German man, married to an English woman, and he did the same kind of work that Joe did. Uh-huh. Then Louis Catherine was another near roommate. Now, the three of us had the three rooms on the front of Saïs, on the second floor. Another interesting thing about Saïs was we had a secretary to the dean. Do you know the story of how Saïs got started? Has anyone ever told you that?
Which story? Tell me what story is. Yeah.
The dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at mm-hmm. Tufts was a difficult man, and he fought with the president of Tufts. He wanted to be totally independent, and he managed to get Harvard onto his diploma because he got permission for his students to use the Harvard Library, so it was on their diploma, which they didn't have any classes at Harvard. But anyway, this guy was a wheeler dealer. He had a very close friend, a mistress, who was from a wealthy Boston family, who had provided most of the money for the library at Fletcher. And so he conceived the idea of leaving Fletcher and starting a school of advanced and studies in Washington right after the war, where they could use adjuncts from the business, from the government, and where everybody wanted to be in Washington after the war and so forth. And so that's what he did. So he got 19 colleges to sponsor this School of Advanced International Studies. And so he got to be difficult running the school. And so they replaced him. And then they decided it isn't going to work for 19 colleges, so Johns Hopkins was the nearest, and Johns Hopkins took it over. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know exactly what year, but I'm sure you have that in your records. But
1944, 45.
No. Johns Hopkins didn't take over until the 50s.
Okay.
Because the first 5 years, at least, I was the fifth class.
Right. I'm sorry that you were asking.
44, 45, 46, 47, mm-hmm. 46, 47, 48, 49, I was the fifth class. But we were then sponsored by 19 colleges. But then later it was all Johns Hopkins. Now this man brought the library and the librarian to Saiz, mm-hmm. and was often seen in the stacks in compromising positions, according to the rumors. I never saw it myself, but that was the story. At any rate, he had a secretary who was a real crackerjack of a secretary, administrative assistant, and she loved to dance. And so four of us couples used to eat at her house once a month, and each of us would cook one of those times through the year. But every Thursday, there was an adult, not unmarried place. It's now an embassy somewhere on 17th Street or 18th Street. Mm-hmm. And they had dances there, in singles dances. And Washington was very definitely a place of singles in those days. Every Thursday night. And so I used to take Rosemary dancing. It was Rosemary Woods. Mm-hmm. Now, the chairman of the board of Saiz at that time, mm-hmm. was Christian Herter, congressman from Massachusetts and from one of the oldest, the old Lowells, Lawrences, Cabots, and so forth, all of those families. Mm-hmm. And so he liked young Congressman Nixon, and that fall in 48, Nixon won the Senate seat in California by vilifying Helen Gahagan Douglas, the wife of an actor, and that actress herself, and called her a communist. He won the Senate seat. So when he came, he needed an assistant. And so Christian Herter got Rosemary Woods to go work for Nixon. So that's a little bit of background and history.
Yeah.
But we still dance on Thursday night. She lived at that time at 2000 Connecticut Avenue, just across from what's now Hilton.
Okay.
Very nice apartment. She had two or three sisters that were nuns. She's from Youngstown, Ohio, I think, or Zanesville, Ohio, a steel town. And our very Irish family, redheaded. Mm-hmm. Rosemary Woods. And so that's a little note in history. Later on, when she was at the White House with him, I was in Paris with UNESCO at that time, and my daughter was going to the École Bilang in Paris, and all the kids had to write to their heads of state as an exercise. And so they got a letter in the White House that they all thought, you know, they have hundreds of volunteer ladies that read all the correspondence and the interesting ones they sent. Well, one came in which a little girl said she was half American, half Arab, and half English, and studying in Paris. And Rosemary said, "Is the last name Leonard?" So that's another little connection with Rosemary.
Uh-huh.
And Rosemary got together when Nixon was the vice president. Nixon and I got a bunch of Arab Palestinian students to come and meet him. And his mother was a Quaker. Nixon had been read out of the Quakers because he wasn't practically a Quaker. And I said to him, "Your mother used to raise money for the Quaker schools in Ramallah." I'll get back to how I know about that. And I said, "You know all about the Palestine question. So why do you always vote on the side of the Zionists?" And he said, "The Arabs don't vote in America." And I said, "So the moral question has nothing to do with it." And so he said to Rosemary, "Do I have to listen to this man?" He turned his face on me and wouldn't speak to me the rest of the day. Didn't shake my hand when I left. But so, little sidelight. Mm-hmm. All right, now, I had a wonderful time at Saiz, and our French teacher was a young woman, Anne Cellier. She's now Anne Cellier de Lattre. And Anne was a brilliant student, but the family, one of the most prominent families in Paris socially, their mother's family, the Devendels, the Carnegies of France, and they own a home, it's a whole city block on the Seine, two blocks from the Palais Chaillot. Mm-hmm. And but they couldn't get a penny out of France in those days. So Anne had gone to Columbia and did a master's in English literature, because she'd graduated from the Sorbonne at something like 17 during the war. And she was a classmate and roommate of Anne Kirkpatrick, who was our ambassador to the UN. Anne Kirkpatrick or something like that. Anyway, they were roommates there and remained friends all their lives. And Anne taught French to us at Saïs. And now another little story. We had a French ambassador there, was Monsieur Bonnet. His wife was a Jewish woman from Alexandria, Egypt, who during the war had a hat shop on Park Avenue or Fifth Avenue in New York and made a lot of money. And the French diplomatic corps didn't have anyone with money enough to run the embassy. In those days, ambassadors had to do a lot of the entertaining on their own money. So Monsieur Bonnet and Madame Bonnet were ambassadors and living in that beautiful stone house on Rock Creek Park, just off Connecticut Avenue. And at that Easter time, she had as her guest Marlene Dietrich. And so they had a dinner party in which they invited Anne, because Madame Bonnet was very interested in being in society in Paris. Mm-hmm. And Anne was invited. And so I sat next to Marlene Dietrich at the dinner table. And during the dinner, Marlene Dietrich told a story of going into Paris on the day it was liberated and getting her driver to take her up to Montmartre, where she had a seamstress that used to make her underwear. And they were shot at two or three times. The Germans were still in Paris at that time. When they got there, this young woman said, "I had gotten in a shipment of Vietnamese silk just before," skin-colored silk, "just before the war began. So I spent the war making underwear for you and embroidered and all this kind of stuff." And she says, "See," and she opened her dress to show us the bra she was wearing, but it was beautifully embroidered and so on. And so I was, of course, East Tennessee hillbilly sitting at the ambassador's table. I was way out of my element. Anyway, years later, when I was at Oxford doing postdoctoral work, Dietrich came and did a show, and so I sent my card back and went back afterwards. And of course, she didn't remember even, didn't expect her to, but I told her this story. And she laughed and says, "Yes, I'm still wearing it," and opened her dress to show other underwear. She had a lifetime of underwear made by this young woman that done that all during the war. Anyway, and then I met her on a couple of other occasions. She was that time doing all of her concerts in England when I was living in England. So I got to see her, and the next time I saw her, she did remember, and told the story, and had a big laugh about it. So.
That's great. And so, what else do you remember about being at Saïs?
Well, I was way out of my elephant academic. Oh, one of the most interesting people we had in the faculty was Brigadier General James Hayworth Dunn. And I don't remember if he was Sir James Hayworth Dunn or not, but he had worked during the war in British intelligence in Egypt. He was a cross between Winston Churchill and King Farouk of Egypt, and with the worst qualities of both. He was a very heavy drinker. He was a big, big fat man. He was full of energy. He slept only three or four hours a day, and was into everything and so forth. And he had become a Muslim in order to be the advisor to Hassan al-Banna, the founder of Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood. And so he told us all this, of course, and I never knew whether to believe half of what he said or not, because the stories were just out of this world. And he married, after he became Muslim, married Carioca, one of the most famous movie actresses in the Egyptian world, a dancer and singer, and greatly loved by the Arabs, not as great as Ibn Khaldun, but was a great character. And then he married a very rich Egyptian cotton heiress. And so when Saïs hired him, they said they'd pay his transport from England to America. So he came on the Normandy with a suite and with two servants and his own car and so forth and so on. Saïs was not amused. He stayed just 1 year. But Hassan al-Banna was killed that Thanksgiving weekend, if I remember correctly, Thanksgiving 1948 in Egypt, probably by the British intelligence. And within a month or so, his son-in-law, his heir, because he had no sons and daughters, his son-in-law came to see Hayworth Dunn, and I met him. And this man was a drinker, he was a gambler, he was a womanizer, and he effectively destroyed the puritanical reputation of the Ikhwan al-Muslimin. Hassan al-Banna had founded the Muslim Brotherhood on the basis of the YMCA. You know, self-help, keep yourself clean, clean your mind, clean your body, clean your soul, all this kind of thing. And it would start out from the villages. It's the only organization ever in the history of Egypt that started in the villages and went up to the capital instead of the other way around. Mm-hmm. And we got to meet this man in Hayworth Dunn's class. Mm-hmm. Another person we had was, gone for a minute. He was an AUB graduate and worked at the agriculture department. It'll come to me in a minute. Mm-hmm. But he was the Middle East expert at the agriculture department. But he was from the class with Charles Malik and all these very great people from AUB, American University of Beirut, and several of his sisters and brothers also graduated from AUB. He was in the Protestant group in the north of Lebanon that went to AUB, American University of Beirut. And okay, now that's another story. Another story, that October was the year Truman was running for president on his own, and no one in the country thought he could be elected. And two boys, Bob Hall, and one other person. Now, I don't remember if Bob Hall was the one who later was alumni secretary of SAIS. I think the first alumni secretary, first full-time alumni secretary. Mm-hmm. The other one, these two boarded in the house opposite the Quaker meeting on Florida Avenue. And it's a house that comes to a point. It's a tiny little house. And the woman that owned it was the daughter of an admiral, American admiral. And she was an astrologist. And so she did the chart for Truman and Dewey and told us early in October, told these boys, that her boarders, that are rumors, that Truman was going to win. Well, we thought it was so funny that I had a friend who was Navy Secretary, Navy Attaché, or Assistant Navy Attaché, to Truman in the White House. And he used to take Margaret as an escort whenever she needed somebody and didn't have a date. He was trotted out. And so I told him the story. So he brought Margaret to this house and met this woman. And they told the reporters about it. Everyone, of course, thought it was very funny. But then after he won, she got quite a reputation in town. But that's, I think Bob Hall later worked for Saucony Vacuum in Beirut. One of them did, the one that was not executive secretary of the secretary of the alumni. And so, but they were characters at the school. And let's see what other stories I have of SAIS.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your career and what you launched into when you graduated.
Well, when I graduated, Aramco had the scholarship in order to have a pool from which to choose people to work for them. And I was not chosen. Now, whether I'm just not the establishment type, or which I'm not, which probably was pretty evident by then, or whether they didn't hire me to go to work for Aramco. And I'm quite glad, because I didn't want to be an interpreter on the tap line or something, buy goodies for the Saudi royal family, which Aramco provided people to do that, and all these favors. Anyway, I didn't get a job. So I did get a job with Union Carbide to go to India as to work for Union Carbide, Evergreen Batteries. Mm-hmm. And then before they sent me out, they had me work in my area in the southeast, and I decided that was not for me, so I didn't do that. Instead, the Quakers have schools in Ramallah. Now, at the time I was at SAIS, we didn't have an auditorium in the building. Sometimes we had lectures we met in the dining room, but was a big lecture, we used the Quaker meeting on Florida Avenue, just two blocks away. So, who are these Quakers? I was raised an Episcopalian and in East Tennessee, and had never seen a Quaker, though my family way back were Quakers before they came to Tennessee in the 1700s. Anyway, started going to Quaker meeting, and the secretary to the leader of the meeting had been a teacher at the schools in Ramallah. Mm-hmm. Quakers started girls' schools in Ramallah in 1866. And then 1901, they started the boys' school. So these two schools became the very best schools in Palestine, certainly the best in English. Mm-hmm. And they, at the same time, they started a school at Ramallah and Lebanon. And in 1888, both the British and American friends had supported both schools. After 1888, the British took the one in Ramallah, and the Americans took the one in Ramallah. Should have been the other way around, as it turned out, because AUB, American University, was right there near Ramallah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Ramallah graduates went to AUB. And the British later were mandated over Palestine, so it would have been better for the English to have been there, but that isn't the way it worked. And so I found out they had a scholarship or a fellowship for somebody to come teach for a year. So I applied in 1950 and did not get it. But they said if I wanted to come and teach English, because they were looking for a science teacher, if I wanted to come teach English, for $800 they would give me to teach the whole year and board and room. So I accepted. And friends of mine, both architectural students, were traveling through Europe that summer of 50. So I decided I'd go with them as far as Venice, and then I would go on. I looked, all my life as a kid, I used to travel in the National Geographic on rainy days, get out the maps and travel here to there and read the stories and everywhere. So I decided I would go from Paris to Jerusalem overland, so I could see Italy and Yugoslavia and Greece and Turkey and Syria and so forth. Mm-hmm. And probably I was the first person to do it after World War II, because when I was in Paris, I couldn't get a visa to Yugoslavia. But when I got to Rome, I got one. Uh-huh. I was got one of the first 50 visas. And when I got to the Yugoslav-Greek border, they'd been fighting 2 weeks before. And they showed me, the Yugoslavs showed me how to follow chalk lines through the minefields to get to the Greek border. So that was quite an adventure.
Wow.
And so I have letters of that I wrote back to the family about all of those adventures. And so I went overland all the way to Ramallah I went on by train across Turkey and to Aleppo, and then you have what we call service taxis. You buy a seat in the taxi. Mm-hmm. And then when it's full, it goes on to the next town and so on. So I went to Aleppo to Damascus in a service, and Damascus to Amman in a service, and from Amman to Jerusalem in a service taxi. Mm-hmm. And then from there to Ramallah.
Wow.
So I taught that year in Ramallah. Mm-hmm. And got hooked on Ramallah, and then came back. The Korean War began. Mm-hmm. When I was in Paris that summer on the way. And because I had not been 2 years in the service in World War II, they drafted me. Mm-hmm. So, and I had gone to the Naval Academy as a kid, mm-hmm. 18. So when I said I'm a conscientious objector, having started being interested in the Quakers and pacifism, incidentally, I started reading Tolstoy at the Naval Academy, so I was pretty fed up with authoritarian. I was really anti-authoritarian. I wasn't so much a pacifist. It was just nobody was going to tell me who to kill. It was really a rebel. So I was drafted, but I can't. And so I was planning to go from Ramallah and teach a year in India in Kashmir, and then teach a year in Japan at the Quaker School in Tokyo, in order to see the world, because I didn't have money enough to travel around to see it, and I wanted to see it deeply. I didn't want just to flip through like a tourist. So, I had to come back because of my draft case in 51. So, but at Easter time in 1951, in Ramallah, I had gone to Amman and bought a small motorcycle and drove it to Petra. And then I drove that back to Haifa when I left and put it on the ship and brought it back to America. So I was planning to drive it all the way around the world.
Right.
A little bit nutty. And so that's how I got involved with the Quakers. So I taught in Ramallah and came back to this country with a conscientious objector's case, and I fought the case for 3 years and finally won conscientious objector's status. Mm-hmm. Spent a short time in jail, but not long, and because they made stupid mistakes in my case, the reason I got a chance to go through it. By that time, I was studying Arabic and Islam at Kennedy School of Missions Hartford Seminary, after I came back from the Middle East. And so then I got, then I applied to go back and teach in Ramallah. Instead, they put me in charge of the Quaker work in Ramallah. So I went back in 55, 57 to do that. By that time, I spoke the colloquial quite well. And in 57, that summer, when I was coming back to this country, I met and married a Palestinian girl living in Beirut and brought her back here. And then we went to Harvard to work on my PhD. So that's it.
And then after you went to Harvard, what did you? How did your career continue?
Oh, because I was a teacher, I never made money, and I never worked for businesses and things like that. But I went back and worked for UNRWA, UN Relief Agency for Palestine Refugees, as an assistant to the director of education. And then after I finished my doctorate, I went back and was advisor to UNRWA, 82 to 87, 86, 4 years, and then 1 year with UNDP in Jerusalem. And so then after that, I stayed on in Ramallah and started a program to try to teach teachers how to teach discussion-based education on my own, partly on a Fulbright and partly money from other sources to just to get by. And finally, when I spent up all my money, I quit and came home in 1996. And but I've continued to go back, and I have a program now with the Ministry of Education in Jordan. And we now have 1 hour of discussion, open-ended discussion, for all children in all the schools in Jordan, 6th to the 10th grade. And I'm still working on that, and I go back on the 15th of March for that. Now, I've skipped over quite a bit. When I came back, I decided I tried to save the world for a number of years, and the world didn't look any more saved than when I started. So I decided when I came back, my daughter had convinced me to come back in 96 because she and her husband were moving to England with my grandson. And so she wanted me to look after her house in Cleveland Park behind the Uptown Theater, 29th Street in Cleveland Park. So I did that, and I decided, okay, I'm going to study Shakespearean acting. So I studied Shakespearean acting with the Washington Shakespeare Theater. Not very good at Shakespearean acting because I'm not good at remembering the exact words. If I decided just to be an actor, where I could have ad-libbed and been spontaneous, I probably could have been an actor. But I did that for a couple of years and then gave that up. And I was staying with a friend in New York in 2004, just as we got into the Iraq War, and I was so angry. I was screaming, we need to do something. So I suddenly said, well, why don't I run for Congress? My district in East Tennessee is first district, up the upper corner of East Tennessee. It's been Republican since the Civil War. The people there vote congenitally Republican. Sound nice and diseased, congenitally. They still think they were voting for Abraham Lincoln. And so I went down and won the Democratic nomination, more votes than everybody else on the Democratic ticket together. And I got a higher percentage of votes than any Democrat had gotten in 100 years, 30%. Nobody got more than 23% before. But that's a long way from winning. But when I went down to run, the National Guard in East Tennessee had just gotten orders that they were going to Iraq. So knowing, as a conscientious objector, East Tennessee's the volunteer state, and I was deep trouble with the veterans in East Tennessee. So I called the executive officer of the National Guard and said, do you want somebody who can give you background material for your people going to Iraq? So I gave 3 2-hour lectures to each of 8 units in East Tennessee. And then I went to Iraq. This is spring 2005. I went to Iraq for 3 weeks with the Christian Peacemaker team. No guards, no armor, no nothing. And then I was embedded as a journalist with the Tennessee National Guard for 5 weeks in Iraq. And I think probably our unit, I know our unit at that time was the only one that had recruited, trained, and left Iraqis in their place because they knew how to deal with Iraqis. And because they were average age 42, not 22 like the soldiers. But I think that Iraq is, going into Iraq is one of the biggest mistakes America ever made. But even when we went in, we weren't very smart. We had only 12 people in the army that knew Arabic. We've used 6,500 Kurds as interpreters. The 45 in my unit, of the 45, maybe five knew the languages well, English well. 35 of that 45 didn't have better than third grade English. And that more people didn't get killed is amazing to me. But the British had ruled Iraq from the air and with subsidies, bribes to the sheikhs, Sunni sheikhs, and intelligence, spies. Why didn't we do that? Now, when we so-called surge, when we sent an extra 35,000 troops, and suddenly the Sunnis stopped fighting so much, it wasn't because of the 35,000 troops, it's because we finally started bribing the Sunni sheikhs. They wanted to be bribed then because the young men in the street were taking over the leadership by their violence against America. Over 1,000 of the Marines that were killed in Ramadi and western Iraq would not have died if we'd been smart enough to have used subsidies as bribes with the sheikhs from the beginning. This has been very, very badly run. And anybody of the Saeed's intelligence that could tell you that. I mean, I'm not an Iraqi specialty. I'd never lived in Iraq in my life until I went there with the Christian Peacemaker team. And yet, I knew the Arabs enough to be able to get along. And so that's what I've done with my life. So
that's great. And what are you doing now?
Well, as I told you, I go three or four times. Last year, I was 7 months in Jordan with this program. Mm-hmm. First of March to the middle of August, and the middle of November to the middle of December. I'm going back to the middle of March.
Okay.
Now, all last year, I had terrible pains in my legs and hip from lower spine, lumbar, from pinching. So I went into Johns Hopkins on the 21st of January, Lebanese Shia surgeon, and he opened up four of my vertebrae and took that little thing out, a little wedge out, and now I've had absolutely no pain.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
So and I mean, I really was leaning over 30% to my left and unable to go up and down steps, avoiding even a curb because it was painful to lift my leg that much. And now suddenly, I'm a little stiff. I'm not quite as sprightly, but I'm going back to roaring around the world like I've always done.
That's great. That's great. Wonderful. And what it, like, now thinking about current students at SAIS, what advice might you give current students having all the experiences that you have had?
If they learn a language and become an expert in a country, that's not enough. They need to have a specialty. Law, agriculture, something that they can contribute to it. Because there are many, many people in these countries that know the languages and the culture. And so that's not enough. The other thing is, don't just learn the language, learn the culture. And, oh my goodness, Afif Tanous was the man at SAIS. And Afif Tanous taught us the culture of the Middle East. He took us to a Middle East restaurant that was on I Street at that time, or J Street somewhere, not far from the Foggy Bottom. And he was a Ramallah person. Excuse me. Hello? Yes, Lowell, I'm at SAIS in an interview. Can I talk to you tonight? Call me back at 9. Okay, thank you.
I'll take it out. Don't worry.
That's yeah. Okay. But where was that in the middle of?
We were talking about the professor that you remember taking to the restaurant. Yeah.
He took us there, taught us the different foods, how they were made. He was a remarkably fine and sensitive person. He was a Cornell PhD. And later when I was, my Hartford degree was a joint degree with Syracuse because I was interested in doing literacy work with the Arabs at that time. So it's called Literacy Journalism, Hartford. So when I was at Syracuse, I met people that had known Afif when he was at Cornell. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to Beirut, Afif's sister was married to Mata Akraoui, who was the man that wrote, Iraqi at AUB, who wrote the first book on education in the Arab world. Mm-hmm. Not terribly comprehensive, not terribly deep. But when I was at Hartford Seminary, I worked with Harry Dorman, whose father had been dean of the medical school at AUB for many years, and his mother was the granddaughter of the founder of AUB, mm-hmm. and the daughter of the second president of AUB, and the sister of Mrs. Dodge, who was president of AUB at that time. Uh-huh. And Harry's son, Peter Dorman, is now president of AUB.
Oh, interesting.
And so the what AUB did, American University of Beirut did, there were a bunch of idealistic New Englanders who gave their lives to teach the very best liberal arts, to empowering people to think, education possible. And it transformed the Middle East. Every time you find somebody who was an outstanding leader in the Middle East, mm-hmm. Until the 70s or 80s, graduates. He was an AUB graduate, he or she, AUB, Beirut College for Women. It's a women's college, huh? And these families just, they did fantastic things for Beirut.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about current students and basically saying, no, to, right. that you want to...
They need to learn the culture, not just the language, the culture.
Yeah.
And when you go there, don't run around with all the rich cookie pusher diplomats and so forth, if you're in the diplomatic service. Get to know people that are in the labor movement and the women's movement and the youth movement and this sort of thing. This is the thing that's so shocking about Egypt now and Libya and everywhere else, is that no one knows anything about what the youth believe, because the youth are totally ignored in these countries, even though they're the majority of the population. Mm-hmm. And no expert on Egypt had any idea this was going to happen when it happened. And I think the Egyptians didn't either. They were totally, they caught themselves by surprise. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful thing happening, mm-hmm. provided they can follow through. But so far, we haven't seen much leadership. Mm-hmm. I mean, social media have made it possible for people to get together and communicate. One of the big differences that I think people at SAIS should know, and that is, for 300 years, we're part of the Western emphasis on individualism, individual identity. But the rest of the world, especially the Middle East, Russia, India, China, all the rest of the world, group identity is more important than individual identity. Mm-hmm. So when you say, how can somebody commit suicide as a suicide bomber? Well, if I were a young kid growing up in Gaza, and I became a medical doctor and spent my life serving the people of Gaza and never asked for a penny, I would not win the prestige in Gaza for my family. And that's what it's all about, is your family's honor, your family's prestige and so on, not your own individual. Like a young man who kills himself in the name of Islam. The most interesting thing happening in Egypt now is that it wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood or the three or four other right-wing Islamic groups that are even right and far more fanatical than the Muslim Brotherhood. It wasn't they that did Midan al-Tahrir. And none of our commentators realize that the H in Tahrir is aspirated. It's not Tahrir, it's Tahrir. And it means liberation. Why liberation? That used to be where the In 50, when I went to Cairo the first time, British barracks were there, British soldiers. And before that, French from 1800. So that's the square where they got rid of all the soldiers, Liberation Square. Mm-hmm. And then on the side toward the Nile is the Nile Hilton. Mm-hmm. There's another Hilton down the river. But that's the oldest Nile, the oldest Hilton, right next to the museum. Museum of the Nile Hilton on this side, then the National Democratic Party, and the Senate, and then the Defense Department, and then the American University in Cairo. Mm-hmm. Not the American University of Cairo, American University in Cairo, mm-hmm. which was started by the Northern Presbyterians, and then commercial buildings on the other side. Mm-hmm. So, but it was fascinating what was happening, but also frightening because it was sound bites. Get rid of Mubarak as if that would solve all the problems. Egypt has three times the population they can afford, and one fifth the number of jobs they need. And those that will not be solved by Ikhwan Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood, or anyone. And so they've got to start thinking about those. But the problems are very serious. Now, I have a hard time keeping out of politics, keeping out of analyzing and so forth and so on, because of my years at studies. And Washington is an amazing place for them. And one of the most, I don't know if they realize it, the Friday evening get together downstairs in the lobby or out in the summertime outside in the front courtyard are very important parts for the Saudis people. And they will run into Saudis people wherever they go. I mean, even I was in the fifth class and I was running into people all the time that had been with Saudis or who had studied Arabic with me at Harvard and at Oxford. Mm-hmm. So by all means, work on the culture as well as the language, and realize that language is a tool, but it's also the way in. But you have to be the kind of person that is willing to try to understand other people and get to know. Last year, not this 2009 fall 2009, I was in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, West Bank, and Jerusalem, Israel, and Egypt. I stayed in 10 different homes, 7 different religious groups, religious communities. And in every one of those homes, I was Uncle Graham. Now, I didn't set out to do that, but that is, I would say that's my greatest accomplishment, is being accepted enough that they'll criticize me. They'll say, this is a mistake, you can't do that, you can't do this. But I learned by being part of the community. Mm-hmm. And the Quakers had been in Ramallah for nearly 100 years when I went there. And I'm the first one they ever called by his first name, and not, Quakers call you both names, Graham Leonard, instead of Graham, or, or Dr. Leonard, Mr. Leonard. I was the first one they called Graham, and criticized openly. So that difference between group identity, and then the other thing they need to know, if they're going to work anywhere that was formerly part of the Ottoman Empire, they need to understand the millet system, M-I-L-L-E-T. The thesis on that was written by Alfred Carleton, who had been the head of Aleppo Junior College, run by the United Church of Canada, the Congregationalist Board in Boston. And millet system meant that the Turks took over from the Ottomans, evidently, a system of allowing each religious community to have its own laws and its own courts for marriage, inheritance, and divorce, and any other crime that was within the community. So this meant all these communities remained very different, very separate. And when people ask me, what's the difference between Shia and Sunni in Iraq? Theologically, there's very little difference. Mm-hmm. There's some practical differences. But the main thing is they've each got 500 years of hating each other and killing each other and dumping on each other every time they got a chance. And you don't get over that right away. Mm-hmm. And so people need to understand their history. And they need to understand, for instance, in the Arab world, the Arabic language doesn't have a past, present, and future. It has completed action or incompleted action. So that all the past is kind of rumbled up together. People are still worried about the Crusades. So when Bush makes a stupid remark about our crusade in Iraq, whew, the Middle East was ignited with hatred for him. And he had no way of understanding that. Mm-hmm. But the past, and with the group that I'm working with, the trainers of trainers I'm working with in Jordan now, I did a couple of days on history. And the first thing I've tried to do is to teach them how to do a timeline. They have no timeline in their head. They're all mixed up between Napoleon and Muhammad. I mean, which one came first, they're not sure. So that's something. We just don't begin to understand the different way people look at things. Mm-hmm. And we need to do that. And so when they're studying, they need to learn how to cook and eat the food of the people who were there. Of course, it was very easy. The Arabic food was so marvelous. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoyed that part. I married a Palestinian. And she was a superb cook, apparently from Nazareth. And I have a peculiar, I guess it's a southern, my mother's side, knowing who married who and who was related to who and who was all this kind of thing. I do that. And when I got to the Middle East, I found they all do that. So that put me in quite well. I know the people, the families of Ramallah and the clans and so forth and so on. You know who Hanan Ashrawi is, the spokeswoman for the Palestinians with short hair. Well, I've known Hanan since before she was born. I knew her mother when she was pregnant. Anyway, Hanan had a cousin that came from America to get married. And this cousin came over at the dinner the night before reception the night before the wedding and said, Hanan, this woman keeps calling me auntie. And in Semitic languages, you don't name the person by name, you name the relationship between you. Mm-hmm. So I call my children Baba, and they call me Baba in direct address. They don't refer to me as Baba, but when speaking to me, they say, Ya Baba. And I say, Ya Baba to them. And a woman would say, Ya Mama to her sons, and they would say, Ya Mama to her. But that names the relationship between you. Mm-hmm. And so that's something cultural, that not just language, that's cultural. So this woman kept calling him auntie. So he said, how am I related? Hanan said, I don't know, ask Graham. And it happened that I knew that she had been married to an uncle of his and was divorced and married to someone else. That's why he couldn't recognize the name that she belonged to the family. But I know the people of Ramallah that well, or at least some of the families. Mm-hmm. And that has kept me in very good stead.
That's great. Yeah. Good. Well, thank you so much for being here today. You told a lot of wonderful stories, and we will certainly appreciate having them, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Well, now, Anne, I kept up with Anne Cellier de Lattre, and became Undersecretary of the OECD. She's a very brilliant economist. She it was that had the idea of the Club de Sahel. You remember where the southern part of the Sahara, that's right, the plain Sahel, the plateau, that's now becoming more and more desert. Those countries, there were 100 different agencies and governments and so forth working with them. And she got them all together to start something called the Club de Sahel, in which everyone would cooperate, and the Americans would do this, the British would do that, the Save the Children would do this, and so on, and made a huge difference for the Sahel. Mm-hmm. And so Anne is retired, lives in Paris, has an apartment in Paris. She has 3 daughters, happily married, and lots of grandchildren. And she has the family's chateau is at Ognon, near Chantilly, and not too far from the Charles de Gaulle, unfortunately. And she has a lovely home there, and she's given over her big home, which she refurnished and added to. And when I was in Paris, I used to spend weekends helping her with that. And she now lives in the gardener's cottage, and their daughters share the chateau of hers. Mm-hmm. And the family all own the whole village.
Great.
And so Anne, I still keep up with. Anne, I suppose, the only person that I still know. Oh, one thing. This is the Paul Nietzsche School. Mm-hmm. Paula Pepke, Nietzsche's niece, who was named for him, Paula, was a classmate of ours in 49. Her father is the one that founded Aspen Institute in Colorado, University of Chicago graduate like Nietzsche. And now Nietzsche's his brother-in-law. Now, I don't know whether Pepke married Nietzsche's sister or Nietzsche married Pepke's sister or whether they exchanged. But they are, Nietzsche was, in the State Department, was Paula's uncle. Uh-huh. And Paula was a classmate of ours. I think there were only 6 girls in our class. There was a Marianne Schmidt, who I ran into in Belgrade on that one of the first 50 visas given to Yugoslavia. I was looking around, and there she was. And I've run into Saeed's graduates now. Several of them worked for CIA. Uh-huh. Some secretly, some in jobs that were open. Mm-hmm. But because CIA began as CIA, I think the spring of 49, something like that, fall of 48, spring of 49. It came in from the Army, whatever, the Special Intelligence, whatever it's called, mm-hmm. then became CIA. And so there were many CIA's people in that. Mm-hmm. And there was a fellow from the Philippines, whose name I can't remember right now, who was very interested in Genevieve Collins, and she not in him. His name started with an H, I can't remember his last name. And but it was a very, very interesting group. Oh, one of our classmates, and I shan't use his name, graduated from Harvard from a well-to-do Boston family, father a doctor, and he was the socialist in residence. He then eventually started a newspaper at Dartmouth in the Lebanon Valley, Lebanon, New Hampshire Valley News or something like that. He married a Swiss socialite. That ended in divorce, and he married one of the daughters of Sir Harry Oakes in the Bahamas and became a rich banker in the Bahamas, our socialist classmate. I won't say his name because I don't want to. And then one of our most interesting classmates, Rosenauer, teaches at George Washington. Mm-hmm. And I think he's still alive. Mm-hmm. And he had written a book about Eleanor Roosevelt before he came to CICE. It's a very, and there's a guy named Barrow who was the most, he became a bureaucrat, but he was had a bureaucratic mind. When he arrived, I remember he had his files all set out and all this kind of before computers. And I was very awed by this. We had one very, very brilliant guy from California who eventually burnt out, I'm afraid. It was in the Arabic program. Can't think of anyone else in the Arabic program that I remember. But mm-hmm. And several other very fine professors. I'm trying to think of who particularly. But I did name the three of them. Mm-hmm. Hayworth Dunn was very interesting character, and the stories he told, I can never tell whether to believe them or not, but I suspect he really did work for British intelligence. Mm-hmm. And maybe they threw him out, the reason he came back into academia. Mm-hmm. But he was the kind of professor who would say, this reference is in Italian. It'll take you about 3 or 4 days to learn Italian. And he meant it, and he could do it.
Yeah.
And he had a boy and a girl by this Egyptian, very wealthy Egyptian girl, and a woman, and much younger than he, half his age, I say. And the little boy spoke about four languages. And he said, it's very easy for kids to learn many different languages, provided each person that speaks to that person, to the child, only speaks one language. In other words, if a grandmother speaks Arabic, and a grandfather speaks Armenian, and the kids in the neighborhood speak French, and somebody else speaks English, they learn all those languages, provided that when you start speaking, they have to take time to figure out what language you're speaking, as long as they know. And when I did my PhD in linguistics, applied linguistics at Harvard, and language learning, and that's one of the things that I emphasized, this business of each child. So when our children came along, the grandmother, my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, didn't speak English well, understood it, didn't speak it. So we spoke only Arabic to my children until the time of the divorce. My oldest girl was 6, the youngest 3. When I took them to live in England after the divorce, I received the children of the divorce. The children spoke only Arabic with me until they were 10 and 8. Hmm. And then they learned English in England, not East Tennessee hillbilly. I wanted them to speak real English, not American hillbilly.
Yeah. Well, great.
And so when I ran for Congress in East Tennessee, I was afraid that the people would consider me a carpetbagger, which I was. I hadn't lived in East Tennessee for 60 years. But the family were pioneers, and I related to a lot of people in East Tennessee. But they accepted the fact that I spoke standard American English. Mm-hmm. And somehow they didn't consider me snobbish. Hmm. They accepted, I suppose, because I've never met a stranger, so I think that helped. Mm-hmm. So. But it was a wonderful experience running for Congress, even though I was beaten badly. And the only one Democrat since the Civil War and two brothers ran against each other for Congress, Senate, and governor. Each one served in all three offices. One is a Democrat, one is a Republican. Their mother was my great-grandfather, my great-grandmother's sister. So they were first cousins of my father's father.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I grew up with them.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for all these great stories, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks. An hour and 40 minutes have I now. I think I still have time on the machine.